Red Tail Ring, our live musical guest today on Current State, here live in Studio S, Michael Beauchamp and Laurel Primo, both native Michiganders, have just released their third Roots Americana album. It's called The Heart Swift Foot. They'll be playing selections from that throughout the hour, and we'll be chatting them up later this hour on Current State as well. Red Tail Ring, they perform tonight, by the way, at the 10-Pound Fiddle in East Lansing. We'll also point out a little bit of breaking news from the Twitterverse here today. MERS News reports that State Senator Rebecca Warren will run for the 12th U.S. Congressional District, which is being vacated, of course, by John Dingell. At the top of our program here on Friday, we turn to the unfolding events on the south side of Lansing. Last Tuesday, the Ingham County Health Department notified residents of the Life O'Reilly Mobile Home Park and Campground that they had 10 days to find another place to live. A failing sewage disposal system and other issues have created an urgent health hazard. This evening at 5 is the deadline for all 85 households in the park to be vacated. With just 10 days to relocate hundreds of residents, some who've been there for decades and many who are living on limited resources, it's been especially difficult for local nonprofits and city and county and state officials who have rallied to help resolve the crisis. With us by phone to tell us more about how the effort is going is Dr. Joan Jackson Johnson, the director of the City of Lansing's Human Relations and Community Services Department. Welcome back, as always, Joan.
Thank you, and good morning.
Good morning, and we also welcome Elizabeth Rios, who is an attorney, a supervising attorney for Legal Services of South Central Michigan. She's playing an important role in this as well. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, good morning.
Joan, what is the current situation? How many people are still at the mobile home park?
We estimate that there are approximately 30 to 35 households who have not vacated the premises. Our goal is this morning to place 10 to 15 in public housing. I heard you say earlier that one of the challenges was, you know, financial issues for a lot of the families in finding safe, and I underline safe, affordable housing. So we've been able to do that with about 37 units through public housing and through the generosity of a number of other landlords in the area. Some individuals have chosen to move to other trailer parks, which we have not supported. We have assisted in with boxes and other things, but we have concerns because of regulatory issues with the trailer parks and some of the challenges that our residents have currently faced in O'Reilly Trailer Park.
So you fear that they're leaving one undesirable situation for another situation that is potentially undesirable as well?
Certainly that's possible, again, given the lack of control or the ability of city code compliance or other entities to enter into and regulate challenges that citizens face.
There are 85 units, Joan. About how many individuals are we talking about who are affected by this?
Well, 85 units, seven of those are homeowners, which live in the campground year-round, which is illegal, I'm told. Then the other 78, I would say about 20 of those have been single individuals. There are a lot of families, but in some of the units, multiple singles may be occupying the same unit. One of the challenges that we face is the fact that, you know, we have a lot of people in need in our community. And some, you know, certainly want to take advantage of this opportunity by saying, I've lived here for this long. And if they can't prove, and we can't prove through bills or some local agencies, we cannot accommodate those citizens. We'll make other referrals, but we can't have them piggybacking on a bad situation that we're trying to resolve as quickly as possible.
Mm. And can you update us, remind our listeners of the park's conditions? What has gone wrong? How bad is it?
Well, the park's condition, and I can't speak for the health department because they issued the condemnation order, but I can say through visual inspection from a vehicle because of the smells, it was pretty horrific. I can also say through looking at pictures provided by the health department, I mean, it was one of the most unbelievable situations that I've seen in a long time. And at the age of 65, I've been around the block and back several times. My concern is that, you know, as citizens, as public, private, you know, for-profit, non-profit organizations that have had contact with any of the individuals living there, that I'm not sure how they've managed to sleep, some of them, by not trying to identify other outlets or other living environments for our brothers and sisters. I mean, we have a responsibility, I think, and I believe, to take care of our neighbors. And if we see something, and I encourage citizens who are listening, if you see something that doesn't look right, doesn't smell right, it probably isn't right, call, you know, the city, call, you know, someone to try to get it, it investigated. And for our seniors living in environments that have felt trapped, you know, to me, we stripped people at O'Reilly of their dignity and their respect. They lost hope. They couldn't see a light at the end of the tunnel, so they settled for the only thing they thought was available to them. And shame on us.
I want to talk to Elizabeth Rios here. Elizabeth, you're supervising attorney for Legal Services of South Central Michigan. Tell us what your organization is doing.
Well, we've been part of a larger group of community partners that have kind of come together, collaborated to, you know, try to do something for these tenants because, like Joan said, I mean, you know, this is something that we need to be concerned about, our brothers and sisters living in these types of conditions, and what can we do about it? So we have been available to answer any legal questions that tenants might have. I mean, this is a very, you know, difficult time. I mean, yes, it was atrocious conditions, but the people are still, you know, having to move, and it's a very emotional for them. So we are answering questions. What does a condemnation mean? What do I have to do? Do I have to be out in 10 days? How do I get another place? What are my legal claims that I could have against a landlord, you know, because I'm forced to move out? So we've been one of many community partners that have been there for, you know, three separate days. We just had groups come for an event that made resources available, DHS, CACS, the VOA, Lansing Housing Commission, MISHTA, where, you know, the community really was coming together to make themselves available to help relocate and answer questions for these tenants.
Have you begun thinking about legal options on behalf of the residents?
Absolutely. And I think that there's, you know, various claims available to the tenant based on their specific situation. I mean, we made ourselves available. If the tenants wanted to come talk to us, we met with each and every one. We've also received phone calls in our intake line from tenants that are going through this situation with questions. And the claims, there will be some similar claims. There might be some different claims. I mean, there's claims for people that believed that they had bought the trailer and had title to it or a right to title. There might be rescission claims in those cases. I believe there's constructive eviction cases for all the tenants. I believe there's, you know, cases regarding negligence, breach of contract. So we're assessing.
Do you think
them.
Every resident has some kind of legal option here?
Yes, I believe that every resident would at least have a constructive eviction claim. And the amount of damages that each tenant has incurred as a result of being forced to move is going to be different. So that's where the difference in claims will arise. But I do think that each tenant would have a constructive eviction claim.
And Elizabeth, I understand your Battle Creek office has been dealing with another trailer park with the same owner. This is Steve Ramirez.
Yes.
I know you haven't been directly involved in that situation, but can you give us any kind of sense of whether there are consistencies between that situation and this one here in Lansing?
Well, my knowledge is mostly, you know, about obviously the Life O'Reilly in Lansing, but I can say that there are certainly consistencies in sort of the failures on the part of Steve Ramirez, on the part of, you know, Wayland Holdings in the way that they've operated our park in Lansing and the park in Battle Creek. So the failures to provide a habitable and fit environment for their tenants, the failure to provide a safe environment for their tenants, the failure to, you know, follow the laws that have been imposed upon them, the failure to repair, all of those things, yes, are absolutely the same in Battle Creek.
Are you in touch with him? Is he AWOL? Where is he in this?
I can't answer that. You'd have to contact his attorney for those questions.
Joan, do you know?
I don't.
Okay. How did we get here, Joan? How did it get to the point where these folks only received 10 days notice to leave? And how was this not spotted earlier by some sort of government inspection or oversight?
To my knowledge, and I'm not directly involved with that aspect of it, but in working with the health department, my understanding is that citizens who reside at the trailer park have made over a period of time complaints to the health department, and there has been ongoing investigation, and the documents that I've seen appear to say that the trailer park owners would provide repairs to ABCD, and, you know, extensions were granted and a number of other things. And then, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I mean, when you have contamination, you know, based on health department statement, to the level that they have there, it's certainly not safe for anyone, you know, to be there. Some units are worse than others, but the entire ground with the sewer condition, raw sewer that's out, I mean, it's not safe. I don't know how any of us could allow, you know, people to continue to live there. You know, people are upset, as Elizabeth mentioned, and an emotional attachment. In the paper this morning, there's a senior that I've talked with, and he's not been very kind to me, and I understand his anger, but I hope that people recognize in the end that the city had no obligation to step in, but our mayor said this, you know, will happen. You know, Lansing has to be a safe, habitable place for all of our citizens, not just some. So, you know, we're pulling together resources. We've worked with a lot of community partners. We pulled together 4 meetings at Crystal Ray Church and invited people in. And some, you know, I mean, we've gotten a lot of thank yous from people who've been able to move out. We have people who are attached to animals that no one's going to allow pit bulls into their, you know, places. You know, people with 30 cats, another lady with 11 cats. And when you've had animals, there are a lot of wild cats out there, too. But I really have to sing high praises to the Ingham County Animal Control and the Lansing Animal Shelter for coming out and working with people and providing temporary housing for some of the animals. A man with a snake, you know, out there.
What if folks don't leave, Joan?
Well, if folks don't leave because of the conditions there, my understanding that, you know, a formal process of escorting them from the property will occur. Mm. And I'm not sure if that will be with the Ingham County Sheriff Department or with Lansing Police. We have, I would have to say, a place for everyone to go. Is it a home? Absolutely not at this point. We're not putting any of the residents in shelters. We are motelling individuals until we can move them to that next step. And again, we have probably, you know, today, by the end of the day, we're hopeful that we'll be able to place at least 30 individuals or assist them in moving into different units. And that's a huge success given the market. But it's was a bigger challenge trying to make the financial connections, because we don't want to set people up for failure down the road, and we will follow individuals that we've assisted for 90 days to make sure that there are no problems resulting from, you know, the housing or additional challenges with some landlord. So, you know, again, we are still looking for furniture, and citizens who have gently used furniture can call St. Vincent's de Paul in Lansing, and they will assist. They also are accepting donations on behalf of the residents of Life of Raleigh.
And what's at the top of your list of priorities here just in the next few coming days, Elizabeth Rios?
Well, our priorities are to help in any way we can, assisting in communication to get these tenants housed somewhere safe. And at that point, we will, when they are housed, we will assess all the claims, because the damages that they're incurring, any expenses that they're incurring because they've been forced to leave the property because of a fault and a breach of their landlord, those are things that they can include in potential claims going forward. So what we're doing is assessing those things right now, trying to be support, trying to, you know, be a good community partner to help these tenants get a new place to live that's safe and habitable.
We want to thank Elizabeth Rios, the supervising attorney for Legal Services of South Central Michigan, and Dr. Joan Jackson Johnson, director of Lansing's Human Relations and Community Services Department. Thanks to both of you.
And thank you.
Thank you.
My love stood under a walnut tree over the garden wall. She whispered and said she'd be true to me over the garden wall. She has beautiful eyes and beautiful hair. She's not very tall, so she stood on a chair. And many is the time I've kissed her there over. There's always an A, and there's always a D over the garden wall. There's always a will, and there's always a way over the garden wall. We hadn't much money, but the weddings were cheap, so while her old feller was snoring asleep, with a light and a letter, we managed to creep over.
Red Tail Ring, live from WKAR Studio S. Michael Beauchamp and Laurel Primo. We'll be hearing more from them later in the hour and be talking with these two fine roots Americana musicians from Michigan in just a few minutes. It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Another Democrat has announced her candidacy to represent Lansing and East Lansing in Congress. Susan Grettenberger is the director of Central Michigan University's social work program and an associate professor in that department. In a news release about her candidacy last week, the Lansing resident discussed a theme of economic populism and giving voice to everyday Americans. It's Grettenberger's first run at elected office. She is the second Democrat to enter the race against incumbent Republican Mike Rogers to represent Michigan's 8th District. Former state demographer Ken Darga is also a candidate. We welcome Susan Grettenberger to Current State.
Thank you for having me, Mark. Delighted to be here. And to
did you like your musical reception that,
yeah,
that we gave you?
Thank you,
you
to Red Tail Ring. You all are awesome.
We rolled out the red carpet here for you, Susan.
Shout out to my mom, who's a banjo player and listening right now. So great. Thank you for being here.
Oh, fantastic.
You guys are great.
What made you decide to run for Congress, Susan?
Well, I've lived in this district the entire time that Mike Rogers has been in Congress and watched the policies that he has voted for and how things have gone in our district. I'm the parent of four adopted children. I live over on the west side. My kids went to Lansing Public Schools, and I've seen how important education is. I've watched neighbors in my community lose their homes, lose their jobs. I think we can do better. I think we can have fairer policies for people. I'm a social worker, and I watch people struggle, not able to make a decent amount of money. So I think we can have fairer policies that make it possible for working families to pay their bills and keep their homes and, you know, send
and
their
so
kids
on
to quality schools, yeah.
Do you support Mark Showers and President Obama's calls for a hike in the minimum wage?
I do. If you look at how much people make when they're working full time on minimum wage, they're eligible for food stamps because they're making so little in a lot of cases, and now food stamps have been cut. So I mean, we were watching literally working families who cannot afford to do really basic things right now.
Mm-hmm. Republicans contend if workers are paid more, it'll force businesses to cut elsewhere and lay off people. How do you respond to that?
Well, I'm not sure that argument holds water. I think in the end we still need to pay people a fair wage. I certainly think there are states that have a much higher minimum wage than we do, and their economies seem to be in better shape than ours, honestly. But I think we need to make decisions about how to support working families based on creating opportunities for people to be able to do what's fair, and that is to be able to support their families, mm-hmm. not at the expense of, you know, they're working at a very low minimum wage right now in order to, you know, subsidize other things, and I think that's not fair.
You've attended and worked at universities across Michigan. What are you seeing that you'd like to change in education?
Well, for starters, I think students need, in higher education in particular, I care about public education as well. I think first we start with the K-12. That's fundamental to getting kids to the point where they can even go to college. And I come from a family of teachers. My dad's a minister. My brother's a minister. There are five people in my family that are public school educators. And I think it's really important to make sure that the public schools are supported so that when kids get to college, they're prepared for success at that level. I've got students that are really struggling to make ends meet, and I've had students quit school because they simply couldn't afford it anymore. I have students falling asleep in class because they're working 30 or 40 hours a week. I think we need to do things that make it possible for people who want to go to college, not just young adults, make it possible for anybody who wants to go to college to be able to have that opportunity so that they can then have the skills and the education they need to have good-paying jobs.
Will your experience in education translate into a particular – would you like that to translate into a particular role in politics?
You know, honestly, I hadn't gotten that far.
Okay.
I'm a social worker, too. There are a lot of things that I care about. I think – you know, when I think about being a parent, like I said, I have four adopted kids who are now 24, 24, 25, 25. And when I think about the future, I want their children to have opportunity. I want their kids to have a good world to live in. I think there are a lot of things that are encompassed by that. And I think being in Congress would allow me to be able to really advocate for not just my own family and my own kids and their kids when they have them, which hopefully won't be just yet, but to advocate for policies that will make our country the kind of place that we, I think, all want to have it be, for our kids to have a good future.
This would be your first experience in elected politics.
That's
you haven't
right.
you haven't
yes.
run for school board or
nope,
town council or
not.
Anything before.
No, I have not.
Wow,
I have not. I've done a lot of things, but that's not one of them.
Impressive. You've suggested that women's rights will be a component of your campaign as well. Tell us about that.
Same as some of the other things. I think that people's rights are really important. There are a number of policies that have been moving us backwards in time, back to another era when we, I think, viewed equality differently. I think women have a right to choose. I think women should have the ability to make decisions about their own lives and not have that imposed on them, have the freedom to do that. So, yeah, I certainly support that.
Tell us a little bit more about yourself. You have, as you've said, you have four kids. You've been on the faculty at Central Michigan University.
Yes, I have. I have been at Central Michigan for 12 years. I'm a social worker. I've worked in a number of community agencies. I have lived in Lansing now for over 20 years. I'm originally from Michigan. My dad, as I said, is a minister. We lived out of the country when I was a kid. We lived out in Argentina. And one of the stories I told when I did my press announcement is that when we were in Argentina, it was in an era when there was a dictator down there, really, and there was a so-called election. But at the time, I remember wondering why our babysitter, who was in her 20s, was going to vote when the election was already decided. And I think one of the things that delights me about being a part of this community and being in the position that I'm in right now is that someone like me, an ordinary citizen who is just a concerned neighbor, an interested district member, voter, can run for public office, even an office at this level, and take a shot at it. And
mm-hmm.
realistically, you know, people like me can get into Congress and maybe make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a social worker. I think I would bring a different voice to Congress than many of the voices that are there, although I think a lot of people know Debbie Stabenow is also a social worker and is a graduate of Michigan State University, which is where I got one of my degrees from. Well, actually, I got two of my degrees from Michigan State, so...
We're talking with Susan Grettenberger, who has announced her candidacy for the 8th Congressional District. She is a Lansing resident. How has the party organization responded to your candidacy? Have you had much contact with Lon Johnson and the party office?
Well, as you know, I recently announced, and so I'm forming relationships with people. I think just across the board, not speaking specifically to them, but I certainly have had a lot of encouragement from friends and family, people who know me well, and I think people have been very supportive generally of me as a candidate.
Do you expect to get the party's support for your bid? There is one other candidate, Ken Darga.
Yeah, there is.
One other Democrat.
Right. There is a primary, and I think appropriately the party will wait to see how the voters vote, and that's appropriate. So I'm good with that.
Are you confident about fundraising?
That's going to be an interesting challenge. As you undoubtedly know, I'm competing against pretty big money here. I think that has been the district's legacy with Mike Rogers. He raises a lot of money. I think without exception, he has raised more money each election cycle from corporate PACs and from big business kind of interests. I think fundraising is going to be hugely important, as it is in any congressional race. I think it's unfortunate in the United States that money now drives as much as it does, and I'm going to have to rely on at least starting out, on people that believe in what I'm trying to do here and who want the district to be more fair. I'm gonna need to get a lot of people giving smaller donations. My niece, who is she 2 years with AmeriCorps, and now for the first year of is in the first year of a full-time position where she's actually getting a regular wage, has pledged $20 a month for the duration of the campaign. Those are the kinds of contributions I'm going to have to rely on. I'm hoping certainly this is going to be necessary at some point to get some of the bigger donations, or this is going to be.
Well, not many people know who you are either.
This is true.
How do you intend to address that? You're going to lace up your running shoes here at some point and going to be consuming a lot of rubber chicken here soon.
I hope not.
That's kind of what you signed on here, though, for to an extent.
I know. I've got all that homemade tomato sauce and spaghetti sauce in my freezer at home.
Just bring it with you.
Yeah, that's
right.
I'm going to have to do something about that. I'm going to have to work to get my name out.
Yeah.
I mean, that's clearly what I have before me, and I have had a number of people who have told me they're willing to help, and so I'm going to do what any candidate does, and that is do everything I can to get my name out. The good thing about a name like Grettenberger is once you see it after a while, you kind of don't forget it anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's easy to spell. All E's, double T's. It's long, but it's easy. So.
We want to thank Susan Grettenberger, a Democratic candidate for the 8th Congressional District from Lansing, for joining us on Current State.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Our pleasure. The sounds of Red Tail Ring performing tonight at the 10-Pound Fiddle Concert Series here in East Lansing. They are Michael Beauchamp and Laurel Primo, and we will be hearing more and talking with Michael and Laurel coming up in just a few minutes here on Current State. They're sounding fantastic. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us today on Current State. Last week, NASA announced its latest findings from the Kepler mission. Kepler's a space telescope that was launched in 2009 to look for habitable planets. Current State's Emmanuel Berry sat down with an astronomer to learn more about Kepler's findings. Emmanuel, do we have any new neighbors we just found out about?
Well, yes and no. Kepler has identified 715 new planets within our galaxy. But as for neighboring planets, these are really, 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 really far away.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah. And as you can tell from my units of measurement, I'm not a scientist. really is not a measurement, unfortunately. So I spoke with Megan Donahue, an MSU professor in physics and astronomy, and she helped me break down Kepler's latest findings.
Kepler is a relatively small telescope. It's only about 1.5 meters in diameter. For comparison, the Hubble Space Telescope is 2.4 meters in diameter, and the biggest telescopes that we have on the ground are 10 meters in diameter. So it's not a big telescope, and it was designed to look at one small patch of sky and just stare at this piece of sky and measure the brightnesses of these 100,000 stars or so, and just keep measuring them over and over and wait for those stars to vary. And in particular, they're looking for eclipses of those stars to search for planets.
So are we also looking at orbit to try and determine if they're similar to Earth or not, or how does that work?
Right. So one thing to remember is that the period of a planet's orbit around its star is related to the size of the orbit, with the longer periods corresponding to the larger orbits. And so we can figure out how far the planet is from its host star by measuring the period of the orbit. So if the period repeats every 4 days, if the eclipse happens every 4 days, we know the period is very short and that planet is really close in to its host star. Whereas if the period were 1 year, we know the planet is perhaps the distance of the Earth from the sun, because that's the Earth's period around the sun. That relationship is affected by the mass of the star. So we also need to know what kind of star it's orbiting, but that's usually a pretty easy thing to do. Most of these stars are less massive than the sun. And we can use the relationship between star mass, the period of the orbit, and the size of the orbit to figure out how far these planets are from the host star. And so we're looking for planets in the habitability zone, which is another aspect of being sort of Earth-like. And those are planets that are not too far from the sun and not too close to the sun to have possibility of liquid water on their surfaces. And this is sort of called the Goldilocks zone for planets. And
just right. Yeah.
And so these planets around our own, in our own solar system, would be, you know, somewhere between 1/2 of an astronomical unit, which is the average distance of the Earth to the sun. So between 1/2 and 2 astronomical units. So planets in that range from our own sun would be considered in the Goldilocks zone, or the habitable zone.
Last week, NASA announced the discovery of over 715 new planets through Kepler. What are these planets like? I mean, do we have a sense of size, or how many of them fit into this Earth-like habitable zone?
Well, a small fraction of them are in this habitable zone, because the habitable zone has only been possible to probe that as the mission has aged. So The earliest part of the mission, we were able to catch all those planets with very short periods, because if it has a 4-day period, it's
You're
going to repeat 10 times a month. So astronomers will be convinced that those are actual real planets much earlier than it is for a planet that only repeats like once a year. So this last batch of planets gives us our highest boost in our knowledge of planets in the habitable zone ever. It's our highest boost in the number of planets ever, right? Because it almost doubled the number of planets that we even knew about. And the surprising thing about these planets, and the surprising thing that Kepler has revealed to us about planets, is that there are a lot of planets that are not like the planets in our own solar system. So
how are they different? Yeah.
Well, the important thing, that these planets are probably rocky, watery planets that aren't quite as dense as the Earth, but much more dense than a gas giant. And they're about 2 to 4 times the diameter of the Earth.
So big, rocky, watery
planets. Big, rocky, watery planets. And we don't have any counterparts in our own solar system. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when we're trying to figure out how planets form, it's good to have a lot of examples of planets. And really our own solar system gives us some examples of rocky, relatively dry planets. Even our Earth has, although it has water on it, it's a lot of water compared to how much rock there is.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have these gas giants that are farther away and presumably formed in the outer solar system because they could acquire ices as well as rock, and then they could hold on to their hydrogen compound atmospheres. And so those planets are largely gas. And so they're not as dense as the what we call the rocky planets or terrestrial planets. And then we have nothing really in between. And so this last batch of planets from Kepler, there's a lot of these sort of super Earth-sized planets. There's also a number of gas giants that are smaller than Neptune. So we're filling in the gaps.
Gas giants.
Small gas giants, large terrestrial planets, and, of course, the very first planets that we discovered outside our own solar system were these things called hot Jupiters, which, of course, we don't have in our own solar system either.
Yeah.
And those are presumably gas giants that formed well outside in the solar system and then somehow migrated in early in this, the solar system's formation as it was still interacting with the disk and so forth. And then it comes in closer. It gets heated up but not destroyed. And those planets are also unexpected and were really a puzzle when they were first discovered.
So these planets, how far away are we talking?
Unfortunately or fortunately, all these planets are very far away. Kepler looked at a part of the sky that was towards the galactic center, so the number of stars in its field of view was huge. And that was the part of the idea, that it wanted to look in the direction of space that had a lot of stars and not a whole lot of really, really bright stars. Because those really, really bright stars, you can imagine, saturate your image and cause mm-hmm. all kinds of problems. So you want to look at a place where you're not looking at, you know, Sirius or Alpha Centauri, but somewhere in a more average part of the universe, I mean, of the galaxy, but at in a high density direction, so you get a lot for your pointing, your
yeah.
one picture. They wanted to maximize the number of stars for which they could measure individual light curves, and so many of these stars are many thousands of light years away.
Unfortunately, Kepler had an accident of sorts or is no longer in commission, but although there's information still being processed. But what exactly happened?
Every spacecraft has a certain number of parts that, you know, allow it to change its pointing or keep it on track or adjust its angular momentum and things like that. And the that can limit its lifetime. So once these things break, then that's the end of the life of the telescope. This mission was designed for 5 years. It lasted a little over 6 or 7. And the engineers would say,
success.
Success.
Yeah.
We win because we designed it to last 5, and it lasted pretty much exactly that long. And then one of these random events that are inevitably going to happen, just as when you buy a car and you keep it running forever and ever, it's eventually going to break. You don't know exactly what's going to break, but something will break. And for Kepler, it was these reaction wheels.
Although it's out of commission, I guess, what legacy does it leave behind, or what are the greatest takeaways from the mission for you as someone who works in astronomy and physics?
It's an example of a very simple, focused mission that did a lot of science, and it was primarily aimed at discovering planets. When Kepler was launched, people had no idea how common planets were, and in particular, they had no idea how common Earth-like or rocky planets were. We knew that there are these hot Jupiters, but we didn't know whether they were around 1% of stars or 10% of stars, or and whether hot Jupiters were the rule or the exception. And it turns out that the fraction of stars with planets is nearly every star. And many planets have multiple stars. We had no idea about those numbers 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of debate about those numbers, even as recently as 5, 4, 3 years ago. And Kepler definitively answered in the positive, planets are common. Multiple planetary systems are common. There are examples of planets that are completely unlike the ones we see in our solar system. You know, there are, we know that there are 10 to the 22 stars in our observable universe. That's one with 22 zeros. And if nearly all of them have planets, that's an awful lot of planets.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Megan Donahue is a professor of physics and astronomy at Michigan State University. Megan, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
It's Current State on WKAR. All this hour, we have been listening to the sounds of Red Tail Ring. Red Tail Ring is Michael Beauchamp and Laurel Primo. They're performing tonight at the 10-Pound Fiddle here in East Lansing. They've got 3 albums under their belt, and tonight's performance is a tribute to the Carter family. We're going to hear them perform one of those songs now. This is No Depression in Heaven by the Carter family. Again, Red Tail Ring on Current State.
For fear the hearts of men are failing, for these are latter days we know. Great depression now is spreading, God's word declared it would be so. I'm going where there's no depression, to the lovely land free from care. I'll leave this world of toil and trouble. My home's in heaven, I'm going there. In that bright land, there'll be no hunger, no orphan children crying for bread, no weeping widows, toil or struggle, no shrouds, no coffins, and no death. I'm going where there's no depression, to the lovely land free from care. I'll leave this world of toil and trouble. My home's in heaven, I'm going there. This dark hour of midnight nearing, tribulation time has come. The storms will hurl the midnight fears, sweep lost millions to their doom. I'm going where there's is no depression to the lovely land that's free from care. I'll leave this world of toil and trouble. My home's in heaven, I'm going there. My home's in heaven, I'm going there.
Red Tail Ring, live in Studio S here at WKAR on Current State. Michael Beauchamp on the Martin Six String and singing, along with his partner Laurel Primo on banjo. They perform tonight. It's a Carter Family tribute, and that last song, No Depression in Heaven, originally done by the Carter Family. You'll hear more of that tonight at the 10-Pound Fiddle concert series. They work fiddle, banjo, mandolin, even the jaw harp into their act, with obviously some very tight traditional harmonies as well. Welcome to East Lansing. Welcome back to East Lansing.
Thank you.
This is your second time to the 10-Pound Fiddle, I understand.
That's right.
Yeah.
How did you guys hook up then?
As a band?
Yeah.
Well, we were just both playing a lot of music around in Michigan. As you know, there's a great roots music scene and just music in general.
A lot of it is right here, too.
People love to play it and people love to listen to it.
Yeah.
So we were just both playing in different bands and circling around the same paths in Michigan. Finally got to meet each other and sat down and played one tune on the banjo and the mandolin and kept doing that ever since.
And you were off to the races.
Yep.
And you both attended the University of Michigan.
Yes.
Is that right? Did you make music together when you were there?
We didn't know each other.
Okay.
But had a lot of fun with other Ann Arbor groups.
Are you trained? Are you trained in this? Self-taught, or how does that break down?
Well, we're house trained, but other than that,
well, that's encouraging.
Not too much.
Michael.
Saying a lot for folk musicians.
Yeah, that's right. No, I have a degree in ethnomusicology, which is kind of the cultural study of music.
Yeah.
So it ties in really well with what we're doing now with this old folk music and old Appalachian music. And so it's interesting to have a degree in ethnomusicology because I feel like it prepared me to do a lot of the research that we do now in our work, although in terms of having any other job in the world, I'm not sure it has.
Yeah.
But I'm happy I have this one, for sure.
What about fiddle for you, Laurel?
Oh, I grew up playing a lot of fiddle with my mom in my house.
Okay.
So that was a lucky first start.
So it was more organic than it was really lessons and things?
I've done it all.
Okay.
I did a lot of organic learning, just wanting to join in playing with my parents and my household, but also went to music school and took plenty of lessons along the way. So,
have you experimented with other styles of music at all? You're such naturals at this, but I mean, a musical journey for a young person can take all kinds of paths. You ever plugged in a
many a
Gibson
time.
Les Paul and let her rip, Michael?
Yeah, I was always really wimpy about that kind of thing, though. Les Pauls are pretty heavy, and I always went for the lighter Fender Strats. So, yeah, we've definitely both done that. In college, I was in a ska band, believe it or not.
Oh, and wow. That was just the kind of thing I was hoping you would say.
Yeah, exactly.
And
that was really, really fun. And I've done other kinds of music. When I was in high school, I was in a cover band, and we'd play people's private parties,
sure.
Friends of ours, things like that. But nothing too serious. And more as I went on as a musician, especially when I got into college, I started to think about the acoustic guitar and the electric guitar as separate instruments. And they have such different ways that you can play them, and they inspire different things. And so I really began to see myself as more of an acoustic musician than electrified anything. So that turn was kind of pivotal for me in delving deeper into this kind of music and contemporary folk music and things like that.
Laurel, tell us about your trips to Denmark and Germany. You've played in Europe, which sounds so exciting.
Yeah, the last 2 years have made some big trips for us, and one of those was doing some more kind of workshops and teaching in Denmark. and interacting with Danish students studying their traditional music there. So we were sharing a little bit of American culture with them as, you know, as musicologists. And this past year, we went to Germany and played 19 straight shows in a row and just traveled all around the country as fast as we could. And and we were well received. So we feel like going back.
That sounds like such excitement for young players like yourselves. We're talking with Michael Beauchamp and Laurel Primo. They are Red Tail Ring, and they play tonight at the 10-Pound Fiddle in East Lansing. What's your songwriting process like? Obviously, you do other people's work, but you write your own work as well. What's that creative process like as far as your own songs go?
Well, I think we kind of do it all. Laurel and I individually write songs, and then we'll bring them to the other person, and we'll kind of arrange it as a group and make edits. We're very very fluid in our process. You know, we each make editing decisions on the other person's songs. Generally, though, if I'm leading a song or if Laurel's reading a song, that's the person who wrote the song, with a few exceptions. And a few times on this last album, The Heart Swift Foot, is primarily original. And a few times we wrote songs together from day one. We conceived the lyrics together and talked it all out. And that was really rewarding in a lot of ways and kind of more challenging, a different challenge. It definitely took longer. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we kind of just let things steep in our process. We'll have the basic arrangement, and then we kind of tinker with it. And we tinker with the instrumentation, you know, try it out on the banjo or the fiddle, different types of instruments until we find something that really sits well with the song.
Okay. And you've got a tour. You've got a more elaborate tour coming up soon.
Yeah, we'll be heading out to the East Coast at the end of this month. And I guess on this trip that means some Vermont, some New York, where else would we go into Pennsylvania?
Regionally,
a lot in Pennsylvania.
Regionally, that's a good part of the world.
We love going there.
Demand. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, you guys are going to play us out, and we're looking forward to that. And I'm sure everybody, after hearing you, is looking forward to your performance tonight at the 10-Pound Fiddle Coffee House. What are you going to play for us?
We'll play a Jimmy Rogers tune to kind of, you know, put some good traveling music to end us up here.
One for the road.
T for Texas.
Red Tail Ring on Current State.
T for Texas, T for Tennessee. T for Texas, T for Tennessee. T for little Thelma, made a food out of me. She got eyes like diamonds and her teeth shine just the same. Eyes like diamonds and her teeth shine just the same. She got ruby.
Red Tail Ring, wrapping our show for Friday. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.